I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
It's time for the latest installment in our series we call Unearthed, which is where we talk about all the things that have been literally and figuratively unearthed over the last few months. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you're super familiar with these. And if you're brand new to the show, we do this approximately 4 times a year. In part 1, today's episode, we are going to talk about some updates to previous episodes, some burial sites, walls, which I think is a new one, edibles and potables, and art and architecture. And then we'll be back on Wednesday with part 2 that'll have some other stuff, including a lot of medical finds and a lot of shipwrecks.
So as Tracy said, we'll start with some updates to past episodes. Possibly the biggest news story this quarter has been about Amelia Earhart's plane. Maybe. In January, late January specifically, private exploration company Deep Sea Vision announced the possible discovery of the wreckage of Earhart's plane on the floor of the Pacific Ocean, sitting roughly between Hawaii and Papua New Guinea.
So this might be the first time that we have talked about an Amelia Earhart announcement on Unearthed, and that announcement did not come from an organization called the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. That organization has faced a number of criticisms about its work on the Earhart mystery, so anytime I see a new story, I'm just a little skeptical to start with. It was nice to be sort of starting from scratch, fresh, clean slate with this one. In terms of this specific discovery, though, it is a little too early to say whether it will hold up. Deep Sea Vision released a sonar image of a blob on the ocean floor that is kind of shaped like an airplane, specifically a Lockheed Electra, which is what Earhart and navigator Fred Noonan were flying in when they disappeared.
At the same time, most people's minds are wired for spotting patterns and shapes. So while, yes, the sonar image contains something that's kind of airplane-shaped, it's also hard not to see it as an airplane after being told that's what it might be. In media coverage of this discovery, Deep Sea Vision's CEO Tony Romeo has also acknowledged that it could just be some rocks in the shape of a plane.
So this announcement followed an underwater drone survey that covered about 6,000 square miles of seafloor in the general area where most researchers believe this plane could have gone down. The next step is to try to get a closer look at it by sending a remotely operated vehicle down there to try to get actual photographs of the site that is currently shown as a kind of orangey blob on this sonar image. Past hosts covered Amelia Earhart, including an update that came out on July 16th, 2012.
Next, we haven't done a full episode on the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, which was signed into law in the United States in 1990, but it has come up in a number of past episodes of the show, including several episodes of Unearthed and our three-part episode on Olympic athlete Jim Thorpe. This is a law that applies to agencies that receive federal funds, including museums, and it provides a process for these agencies and institutions to transfer items from their collections to Indigenous nations, Alaska Native corporations, and Native Hawaiian organizations. The law applies to funerary objects, sacred objects, and human remains. Museums and agencies are required to identify these items in their collections and collaborate with the appropriate nations and peoples to repatriate them.
So this law is more than 30 years old at this point, but in December of 2023, the U.S. Department of the Interior announced a final rule in the implementation of this law. These changes followed a period of public comment, and the federal regulators tried to incorporate as many comments as possible as came from tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations. Basically, they were trying to close a lot of loopholes that were keeping items from actually being returned to the appropriate people decades now after this law went into effect. To quote from the press release from the Department of the Interior, these changes included, quote, strengthening the authority and role of tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations in the repatriation process by requiring deference to the indigenous knowledge of lineal descendants, tribes, and NHOs. Requiring museums and federal agencies to obtain free, prior, and informed consent from lineal descendants, tribes, or NHOs before allowing any exhibition of, access to, or research on human remains and cultural items. Eliminating the category culturally unidentifiable human remains and resetting the requirements for cultural affiliation to better align the regulations with congressional intent. Increasing transparency and reporting of holdings or collections and shedding light on collections currently unreported under the existing regulation, requiring museums and federal agencies to consult and update inventories of human remains and associated funerary objects within 5 years of this final rule.
In the words of the introduction of a three-part series on these changes published by Indian Country Today, quote, the new rules are the first get-tough regulations to address collections of human remains and cultural artifacts since NAGPRA was passed more than 30 years ago, and museums and universities are struggling to comply. Tribal leaders say it's about time.
When these rules went into effect earlier this year, a number of museums acknowledged that they did not have free, prior, and informed consent to display items from their collections. Some high-profile museums, including the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology at Harvard University and the Field Museum in Chicago, have elected to close or cover exhibits that did not meet this standard while they figure out what the next steps are. In general, major museums receiving federal funding, whose exhibits are still viewable at this point, have already worked with Indigenous communities to either revise existing exhibits or create entirely new ones in a more collaborative way.
Next, archaeologists in Boccoli in southern Italy have found the site of a 2,000-year-old villa, and there's speculation that it may have belonged to Pliny the Elder, and that he may have even been able to see the eruption of Mount Vesuvius from there, since it offered a 360-degree view of the Gulf of Naples. While we do know that Pliny was living in this general area, his connection to this exact villa is not definite at this point.
This villa was found during construction on a playground. And previous hosts talked about the city of Pompeii and the eruption of Mount Vesuvius all the way back on October 19th, 2009.
Next, we have a few updates to prior installments of Unearthed. We've talked about discoveries at the Roman fort of Vindolanda, south of Hadrian's Wall, in at least 7 previous Unearthed episodes. And the latest find there is bedbugs. Katie Weiss-Jackson, a student at University College Dublin, found 2 insect thoraces believed to belong to the common bedbug in a layer dating to about the year 100 CE. If they're correctly identified, these are the oldest bedbug parts found in Britain so far.
This kind of feels like it combines with a previous find that we talked about on Unearthed years ago, which was evidence that areas that had a lot of Roman influence also had a higher prevalence of intestinal parasites than other places did. That discovery seemed to contradict the perception that Romans were focused on cleanliness and introduced more hygienic practices to the places that they invaded and occupied. This same sort of irony applies with the bedbugs, although to be clear, bedbugs are a very pernicious critter that can infest somebody's living space really regardless of how fastidious they are.
Maybe they were fastidious because they just had problems with bugs and parasites. Next up, remember last fall when we talked about that stolen Van Gogh painting that had been returned in an IKEA bag? That painting was the Parsonage Garden at Nuenen in spring, and it has now been restored and is on display at the Groninger Museum as part of a behind-the-scenes exhibition that's planned to run until the spring of 2025.
Moving on, we've also recently talked a couple of times about a massive theft or series of thefts of artwork and objects from the British Museum. I think that's come up at least twice on Unearthed. Although some of these objects are believed to be permanently lost at this point, some of the ones that the museum has managed to recover are now on display in an exhibition called Rediscovering Gems, and the plan is for that to run until June 2nd, 2024.
Next, the human remains known as Utsi the Iceman have made frequent appearances on Unearthed, as well as being the subject of a full episode. New research has been published in the European Journal of Archaeology in March under the title Chalcolithic Tattooing, Historical and Experimental Evaluation of the Tyrolean Iceman's Body Markings. This paper pulls together a lot of different information about Utsi's 61 tattoos. It walks through those 61 tattoos in detail, and it covers all of the existing ideas about what their purpose may have been. This includes more recent interviews with Inuit culture members in Canada and Greenland about the role that tattoos played in their society prior to forced acculturation.
This paper, in addition to sort of a survey of all of this knowledge, also examines how the tattoos may have been made, and that includes another lengthy overview of tattooing methods through history. And it incorporates some experimental data as well from work that was carried out by four tattoo experts in 2020 and 2021. Machine-free tattoo artist Danny Riday of New Zealand tattooed himself and also worked with three other tattoo experts to create multiple versions of the same motif on his body. This motif looks kind of like a stylized fir tree or some other evergreen. The other tattoo experts included Inuit tattoo artist Maya Sualik Jakobsen of Greenland and archaeologists Aurelien Breleau and Benoit Robitaille.
The paper's authors compared Utsi's tattoos to the various tattoos that were done as part of this project, concluding that Utsi's tattoos were probably made with a single pointed hand-poke tool made of something like bone or metal, rather than through incisions.
Yeah, as I understand it, incisions had been the going hypothesis before this comparison to this tattoo project. To close out these updates, we've also got one from the archaeological site known as Must Farm, which has come up on a couple of installments of Unearthed. This was a stilt village dating to about 850 BCE, roughly 85 miles or 136 kilometers north of modern London as the crow flies. It was destroyed by a fire only about a year after it was built, and because the burned remains of the buildings and all of their contents sank down into the riverbed, a lot of what was there is still very well preserved.
Two books were published on Must Farm in March. One is Must Farm Pile Dwelling Settlement, Volume 1, Landscape, Architecture, and Occupation. Volume 2 is Specialist Reports. These were published as open access, so anyone can read them, and you can get to them from mustfarm.com.
Living in a stilt village built over a river in Britain more than 2,800 years ago might conjure up ideas of kind of a meager existence. But in a news release about these books, researchers described life at Must Farm as one of, quote, cozy domesticity. These homes had similar layouts to modern homes with different spaces used for different purposes. The 60 or so people who lived in them dined on foods like honey-glazed venison, and those foods were prepared in kitchens that were well-appointed with bowls, cups, storage jars, and cooking pots that were made to stack inside of each other to save space.
The textiles made in Warren at Must Farm are described as the finest in Britain during this period, including well-made linen clothing. Several of the structures contained items like spindle whorls and bobbins, and one had a loom situated near a likely entryway, which would have allowed for more light to work by. And the building's construction meant that they were simultaneously well-insulated and well-ventilated.
The publication of these books followed extensive research and archaeological work that took place in 2015 and 2016, and currently no further excavations are planned for this site. Archaeological material was removed from the site and preserved, and then after these excavations were over, the site was recovered and sealed. Objects from the site are now in the collection of the Peterborough Museum and Art Gallery, which is not far away, and an exhibition called Introducing Must Farm, a Bronze Age Settlement, is running there through September 28th, 2024.
Hey, Tracy, I know we have burial sites coming up, which thrills me to the bone, but do you want to take a break first?
Let's do take a break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
A lot of what we've talked about on Unearthed from, you know, before and today, really, has been things that were discovered at a burial site. But this time, we also have some discoveries in which the burial sites themselves are what attracted attention. First, archaeologists have found a burial site on the grounds of Fonmon Castle near Bury, South Wales. This is one that seems to have been used not just for burying the dead, but also for feasts and other gatherings. There's evidence of at least 80 graves there, along with pieces of imported glass drinking vessels and things that you would associate with things like butchery and cooking.
It doesn't seem like people were living nearby, though, so they probably came together to bury the dead and hold some kind of commemorative feast. This site dates back to the early medieval period, and there aren't many archaeological sites in Wales from this time, especially not ones that have preserved bone. The burial sites also include different types of burials, including some with stones lining the graves and some with the person buried in a crouching position.
In another discovery in Wales, some of our listeners are probably familiar with Tintern Abbey because of having to read a poem by William Wordsworth in high school or college. I know I did. Mm-hmm. Today, this is a ruin, but it's still considered a national treasure and a Gothic masterpiece. When it was functioning, it was a place where wealthy and powerful people were buried. The abbey was shut down during the dissolution of the monasteries in the 16th century, and it seems like after that point, there were some people who had much less affluent lives who chose to bury their loved ones on the abbey's grounds. This included a woman who appears to have been disabled and probably died in her 30s or 40s, and two children who seem to have signs of long-term malnutrition and chronic health conditions. It is possible that at least some of these burials happened in secret.
This discovery is part of ongoing restoration work on the abbey. The stonework at the abbey is very soft, and its roof is completely gone, so there has been a lot of erosion. One of the goals of this restoration project is to protect that stonework.
Moving on, archaeologists from the University of Barcelona and the Institute of Ancient Near East have discovered some previously unknown rock-hewn tombs. They date back to the Ptolemaic and Roman eras, so that stretches from about 305 BCE to 641 CE. This site is in the Minya Governorate in Upper Egypt on the banks of the Nile River.
There are spaces carved into the rock that hold Roman-era mummies, and two of them have golden tongues in their mouths. There are also terracotta statues depicting deity Isis Aphrodite, and there aren't similar statues in the historical record.
Next, an early English cemetery was unearthed during work on a project called Viking Link, which I find a delightful name. If you're not local to that area, this is an electricity link connecting the UK to Denmark. This cemetery includes the remains of 23 people, as well as jewelry, pottery, and other items. They all date back to the 6th and 7th centuries CE. This find was also featured on BBC Two's Digging for Britain in January.
Archaeologists have been excavating a Roman cemetery near Holborn Viaduct in central London and have found five oak coffins there, along with a well-preserved funeral bed. All of this is very rare. Most wooden objects from the Roman era in Britain have decayed at this point, and there have only been three timber coffins from that period found in London before now. But the bed was a particular surprise. It was known that funeral observances could involve carrying someone to their burial site on a bed, but not that the bed might also be buried with them. These likely date to between the years 40 and 80 CE.
A 4,000-year-old tomb has been rediscovered in Ireland. This tomb is known as the Altar na Gréine, and back in 1852, antiquarian Richard Hitchcock visited the site and reported that it was no longer there. At that point, most people believed that all of its above-ground elements must have been taken apart and that the stones that had been used for that had been taken somewhere else and reused.
Irish folklorist and archaeologist Billy McFloin was curious about whether anything related to the tomb was still there. He eventually spotted a stone that resembled one in a 19th century sketch of the site by Georgiana Chatterton. He contacted Ireland's National Monuments Service, and he went to the site with archaeologist Kymon O'Brien. They eventually confirmed that they had found the site of the tomb.
So this was built as a wedge tomb with upright stones and capstones across the top. And while only one of these stones is still standing, others do appear to still be there at the site, but now they are buried or partially buried in the soil. So it seems like rather than these being taken away and repurposed somewhere else, someone may have knocked them over, weather may have knocked them over. A lot of it's still there.
Last year, some metal detectorists in Poland found some jewelry in a dry lake bed. After further study, it turns out this may be a site that was used for water burials. Excavations have unearthed human remains from at least 33 people, along with more than 550 bronze objects. These are likely connected to the Lusatian culture, who lived in what's now Poland from about 1300 to 500 BCE. Most of the bronze objects are more recent than the body, so ritual practices here may have shifted over time.
And our next burial site, according to research that was published in December, but then picked up in the media after the first of the year, archaeologists believe they have found three tombs belonging to family members of Alexander the Great, including his father, son, and half-brother. So these tombs themselves are not a new discovery. People already knew about them. They also were already connected to some of Alexander the Great's family. But this paper argues that the previous work to identify the people in these tombs was incorrect.
Okay, so all of the writing about this sounds extremely definite, including some portions of the actual paper, but this still seems more like an argument than a definitive conclusion. For example, Tomb 1 includes a skeleton with a fused knee joint, and King Philip II of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father, was known to have been injured in the knee by a lance. Two other people buried there are believed to be Philip's wife, Queen Cleopatra Eurydice, and their newborn child, based on the likely age of the older skeleton. The second tomb is believed to contain King Aridaeus and his wife, Adea Eurydice, and the third belongs to Alexander IV. Again, this is based on conclusions about things like the ages and sexes of the people in the tombs, and particular details about the bones.
So this is definitely a paper that adds to the ongoing body of work about these tombs. Not really one that answers all possible questions about who these remains belong to, which is what some of the coverage suggests. And honestly, the highlights section of the paper makes it sound like that we've closed the deal on who
Eureka!
These people are. And I did not find it that certain reading the paper.
So moving on. Intel is planning to build semiconductor plants near Magdeburg, Germany, and archaeological work ahead of that construction has unearthed two Neolithic burial mounds covering wooden grave chambers that each held multiple burials. These were built during the Balberg culture, which is 4100 to 3600 BCE, and while they're much smaller today because of erosion, they would have been a dramatic part of the landscape when they were first built. There's also an area where two cattle were sacrificed and buried sometime later, between 3300 and 2800 BCE.
A different team also discovered a Neolithic burial site in France. This one included multiple types of burials, including several mounds. This site appears to have been used for about 4,000 years, or basically the whole Neolithic period.
And lastly, archaeologists have found a tomb in central China dating back to the Warring States period from 475 to 221 BCE. There are 176 tombs at the site, mostly small pits. The larger tombs at the site also include metalware, such as horse bits, spoons, swords, and pots. They also found a chariot burial at this site, with the partial skeletons of two horses and a wooden chariot that has almost completely decayed.
We'll have some more after another sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
In my memory, we have never had a section of Unearthed just called Walls. We might have. If we did, it didn't stick in my memory, but we've got a whole section of walls this time. First, a team of researchers discovered a massive fortification in northern Arabia that's about 4,000 years old and entirely encircles the Khaibar Oasis. Only about half of this wall still exists today, but originally that whole length would have been about 14.5 kilometers long, and the completed wall was about 5 meters high with a thickness of roughly 2 meters. So I feel like meters to yards is a pretty easy conversion, but that's about 8.7 miles long. Tracing the path of where this wall was involved both surveys and remote sensing data.
This is one of the largest such fortifications ever found on the Arabian Peninsula. It most likely protected the land and community within from a variety of threats, including severe weather and raiders.
Next, a sonar survey off the coast of Germany has revealed a half-mile-long stretch of wall made from boulders. This one is believed to have been about 10,000 years old, and when it was built, rather than being underwater, it was probably next to a lake or a marsh. One of the researchers connected to this work also suggested that it might have been used for hunting purposes, basically creating kind of a bottleneck or a barrier to keep reindeer running in a specific direction. This wall has been named the Blinker Wall, and it may be the oldest known megastructure in Europe.
We have another wall in Germany, this one found during an excavation at Aachen. This wall dates to the 3rd century and was likely built by Romans. The section that was unearthed measures 23 feet long and 3 feet thick, and it is not known how long it originally was.
Our fourth and final wall is a massive system of walls in Mongolia, stretching 405 total kilometers, or more than 251 miles. This is actually a wall system that was known about before, but this is the first time it's been really more thoroughly studied and documented. This wall system was built between the 11th and 13th centuries, and in addition to the walls, there's a trench and at least 34 other structures.
All right, now we're moving on to edibles and potables. Archaeologists found what may be one of the oldest surviving royal kitchens in Poland in the basement of a museum. The museum is the Museum of Applied Arts in Poznania, and it's on the site of a royal castle that went through various fires, restorations, and rebuilding over the course of centuries. The kitchen area had a huge pillar that would have supported a stove and a ventilation hood, along with a well in one corner. According to the photos, getting down to this space involves climbing ladders that are perched on ledges and leaning across this giant shaft underneath, and they frankly look utterly terrifying.
Yeah, imagine looking down a giant big chimney, kind of.
Nope.
And there's ladders that are like perched on a ledge on one side of the chimney interior and leaning against the wall of the other side. And I was like, oh, I'm nervous just looking at the ladders there, not even thinking about getting up and down them. Archaeologists in Germany have identified the charred remains inside of a Neolithic cooking pot, concluding that it was porridge. We've definitely had some Neolithic porridge on unearthed before, but this analysis revealed some pretty specific ingredients, including emmer wheat, barley, and white goosefoot. The barley and the wheat were probably grown by farmers, while the white goosefoot would have been a wild plant. So this is an example of both cultivated and wild grains in the same dish. These grains had sprouted, which the researchers said suggested this had been a meal that was made in the early summer.
Speaking of stuff made of wheat, archaeologists working at the Neolithic city of Katalhuk have identified an item from the site as an unbaked loaf of bread. Its ingredients included wheat, barley, and pea seeds, and it was in a corner of a clay oven that dated back to 8,600 years ago.
Next, some research into Roman clay jars suggests that some Roman wines may have had what was described as a spicy character. These were porous, egg-shaped vessels called dolia, which would have been partially buried and sealed up while the wine fermented and aged. According to the researchers, this finished product would have had notes of, quote, toasted bread, apples, roasted walnuts, and curry. But this could have been just a sample of all the different flavors that could have been found in wines in the area. Also, curry is not just one flavor. It's not clear what this note was meant to have tasted like unless they were meaning curry as in like store-bought curry powder from a major national brand, which I would say like that might have a relatively standard flavor, but like curry is a whole style of cuisine.
Yeah. Archaeologists in Barcelona have found the remains of a 19th century chocolate factory. This site was discovered during a building renovation in the old city, which was then paused so that the site could be investigated. It turned out elements of this structure were roughly 600 years old, and like that royal kitchen that we mentioned earlier, there had been various buildings and expansions over the centuries. The 19th century factory was for Catalonian chocolatier Clemente Guardia. Findings included tongs and lead plates that would have been used to label the chocolate.
And this last one is more potable adjacent. Guinness has digitized its archival records, which are now searchable at Ancestry.com. And this might seem like kind of a weird connection, but there is a gap in genealogical research that's available in Ireland because a fire at the public records office in Dublin in the 1920s destroyed a lot of official records from things like the census. This Guinness archive spans from 1799 to 1939, and it includes mostly employee records and trade ledgers. So those employee records might include things like the birth dates of people whose census files and other documents are no longer accessible through the public records office. Ancestry.com is a paid service, but these records were available free of charge for the first 2 weeks after they were announced.
Moving right along to art and architecture, builders working in a roof space at Christ's College, Cambridge, have found medieval wall paintings celebrating the college's royal patron, Lady Margaret Beaufort, mother of Henry VII. These paintings are thought to have been created in the 16th century, and they have been covered up for at least 300 years. They depict a red Lancastrian rose, a portcullis, which was the emblem of the Beaufort family, and what may be a fleur-de-lis.
Next, it's possible that ancient artists who created petroglyphs in Brazil were inspired by fossilized footprints of dinosaurs. This conclusion comes from the work of archaeologists and paleontologists who found petroglyphs and preserved dinosaur footprints in close proximity to one another. And this was described in a paper in the journal Scientific Reports in what to me is a delightfully titled composition. It is called, quote, "A Remarkable Assemblage of Petroglyphs and Dinosaur Footprints in Northeast Brazil."
The petroglyphs are primarily circular motifs that are similar to ones found at other sites in the region. But until now, there haven't been examples of petroglyphs and fossilized footprints in the same place in this way. It suggests that ancient artists saw these footprints as important enough to incorporate them into their art.
Other researchers elsewhere in Brazil also found 16 previously unknown rock art sites, which featured both paintings and engravings. These sites shared some features and motifs with other rock art sites in the area that were already known about. So researchers believe all of these sites might have been created by people who all shared a similar culture and belief system.
We have talked about the Paleolithic art in Covadonis in Spain before. These caves are home to at least 110 paintings, many of them made by scooping clay from the floor and using it to create images on the walls. Clay paintings like this are fairly uncommon, and they've only survived until today because the walls and water in the caves are full of calcium carbonate, which acts as a preservative.
Attempts to use radiocarbon dating to determine the age of the paintings has been ongoing, but there are also a couple of other clues. One is that some of the artwork in these caves uses motifs that are also present at other sites, with those sites dating back to between 21,000 and 40,000 years ago. And another is that one of these paintings in the cave, it turns out, has been damaged by a scratch from a cave bear. And cave bears became extinct about 24,000 years ago, so this would have been made before that point.
Next, archaeologists at Pompeii have found a fresco depicting Greek mythological siblings Phrixus and Hele. In this story, Phrixus and Hele were fleeing their stepmother by sea, and Hele fell into the water and drowned. The fresco depicts Phrixus reaching for his sister as she reaches out from the water. The colors of this fresco are still really vibrant, and authorities at Pompeii hope the home it is part of will be accessible to visitors at some point in the future.
And we're going to end this installment of Unearthed and this art and architecture with a call for help from a museum. National Museums Liverpool is trying to determine the identity of the subject of a painting by William Lindsay Windus. This was painted around 1884 and is known just as The Black Boy. This painting is currently in the collection of Liverpool's International Slavery Museum, and it is the only painting in the collection that depicts a single black child.
This painting depicts a black boy looking directly at the viewer. His feet are bare and his clothing is torn. We don't know who he is, and there's also not a ton of information about the painter, aside from the fact that William Lindsay Windus was born in Liverpool and was seen as a respected artist. It is possible that more information about the artist could eventually lead to information about the people who modeled for him.
The URL for more information about this is at www.liverpoolmuseums.org.uk/call-out-information-about-black-boy, with each of those words separated by dashes. It seems like trying to read all of those dashes would just be confusing. So folks can also get to that page from the liverpoolmuseums.org.uk homepage.
Do you have some listener mail to wrap this one up?
I do have some listener mail to wrap this one up. This email is from Ren, who sent us a message after our episode where we talked about historical etiquette manuals, and I really loved this story. Ren wrote to say, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. I can't believe it was your etiquette episode that finally got my butt in gear to email you. I often think of etiquette as a classist endeavor, but your words about simply not being a jerk really spoke to me. I grew up with a single mom who is a former hippie and an outspoken leftist, so I never really had house rules as a kid except for two. Don't hit and hold hands in the parking lot. I'm sure she meant that literally, since I was a very exuberant kid and prone to excitability and skipping or dancing away from her. However, as I've grown into an adult with no religion or faith and thus no formal commandments to live by, I've often thought about her rules more abstractly. Be kind to others, even if you yourself are hurting, and stick together with the people you love. Thank you for the thoughtful, nuanced, interesting research you do and stories you tell. As an editor with a history degree, I cannot tell you how much I admire you both and how much your work and your career journeys have inspired me. All the best. Ren, P.S. in lieu of a pet tax, please see a selection of memes you may enjoy." I did for sure enjoy these memes. One of them is, I'm just going to have one of an example because there were several. One is, it looks like a medieval illumination sort of, and there is someone sitting with a book, and that's labeled writers doing their thing, and then there's some devils over in the corner of the room, and they are labeled devils, putting typos in, and then up in the heavens, editors being busy. I did find that very funny. I liked all of these memes.
I want them to write an autobiography called Hold Hands in the Parking Lot. That's my input on all this.
Yeah. I loved this whole story. I really did. I loved it when I read it. I loved it when I reread it just now. It got me a little bit choked up. And thank you also for the memes. I do love to be delighted by humorous or insightful memes. So thank you again, Ren, for this email. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we are at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. And we're all over social media at Missed in History. And that is where you can find our Facebook and Pinterest and Instagram and the X thing. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app and wherever you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.